It's been a while, so I'll introduce myself again. Tom Iverson, an alcoholic. And great to see you. Good dinner. Good dinner. That folks catching on over there. It only took them 3 days to get that cooking rolling. You know what? I swear that thing looks tempting right back here. Let me just try this out. Oh, yeah. There is an easier, softer way, I believe. Yeah, I got knee surgery, though, a week or so from now. And at this point, I'm delighted to be having knee surgery coming up. So, yeah, this will help. All right, tonight, we're going to visit in the tradition world, up close and personal, the way I like to look at it. Let me tell you something Bill said about traditions. I didn't hear him, but I know he said it, that the 12 points of tradition are little else than a specific application of the spirit of the 12 steps of recovery to our group life and to our relations with society in general. The recommended steps would make each individual AA member whole with one and with God. The 12 points of tradition would make us one with each other and whole with the world around us. And you know, one of my great highlights in my AA life was the privilege of meeting Bill. And I went up to the 65 International in Toronto, and my real motivation for going was that I wanted to meet Bill. You know, I didn't have a message for him or any advice or anything like that. I just wanted to meet him and assure myself that he was really there, and it wasn't just some kind of a made-up scheme. And so I did. I saw him a lot of times. Most of the time he was wide open, going from one meeting to another, and there were usually thousands of people. And we had a traditions meeting one day, and that usually has a good effect for thinning crowds. And so we had just 35 or 40 of us in a little room in at the Royal York in Toronto. And we sat down. I listened to Bill talk about traditions. And I swear to God, that guy was a true visionary. And the way he talked about traditions and all the stuff he said in his life. Just one thing that he said during that meeting that had a lot of meaning for me and has still to this day. He was talking about tradition and he got into anonymity. And he said, AA was never intended to be a furtive hiding place for alcoholics. The real function of this program, if we take the actions laid out in the program, is to restore us to our rightful place in earth. And he said, if you do this thing, there'll come a day when you'll be able to walk the streets of any city on earth and look anybody you meet in the eye. Now, I think I was 8 years sober at the time. And I was about up to knees in terms of looking folks in the eye. And that sounded like a pretty wild dream, but the boy told the truth. Because today I don't know of any city and any street in this world that I can't comfortably walk and look anybody I meet in the eye with total comfort. Man, that's freedom. That is real freedom. And so that's, I always think about that context when I'm thinking about Bill. In traditions, they can get to be a heavy treading, particularly if you look at it from a corporate viewpoint. You know, if you look at it in terms of how we handle the fellowship and groups and stuff like that, they can get a little tedious, you know, because like any kind of a thing where you're talking about organizational lines, even if they're principles, they're still can be a little tedious. And so a good many years ago, I started using traditions from a personal perspective. And I'll tell you without any hesitation, I consciously use traditions in my day-to-day life more than I do steps. Consciously. Because steps are how I live. I don't have to mechanically work steps. That's what I do. That's just a few, that's part of my, it's like my blood pressure. I don't have to plan that. It just sort of takes care of itself. Traditions, on the other hand, I use very deliberately and planfully in every area of my life. And I'll tell you, a tradition meant more to me when I was working for a living than anything I ever learned in university management training or anything else. Enormously effective for dealing with organizational problems. I'll give you, if California folk here, I'll tell you something if you won't spread it in California. I spoke at a group down in some part of L.A. a while back. The only group I ever went to is on Sunday morning, and when they do anniversaries, they have a piano player that plays the piano while you're celebrating your anniversary. I thought that's pretty cool. I mean, they could have had a bluegrass singer or something up there, I guess, but that was not bad. And after the meeting, we went over, like we'll often do, went over to some place to have a little lunch and hang out and just get casual. And I was sitting with a guy I didn't know, and we started sort of doing howdy-do stuff, you know, like who are you and what's your dog's name, stuff like that. And he started telling me about himself. And this guy, you know, we kid about brain surgeons and rocket scientists and stuff like that. He was not a brain surgeon, but he's a rocket scientist. And he started, now Howard, they would have enthralled each other. But this guy is talking to me about interstellar exploration and he was just fascinated with his story. I didn't know what he was talking about half the time. I knew it had to do with shooting a rocket. And so he goes through this long story about where their next deal was and what they were doing and about how they were getting it done. And, well, there comes a point in the conversation, most of the time, where the person who was talking will stop and look at you expectantly, like, what do you got to say? You know, and so I don't speak rocket scientists, but he gave me an opening. I said, have you ever thought about using AA traditions in what you're talking about? Well, you'd have thought I'd slapped him. You know, he said, AA tradition? I said, yeah. I said, I've been listening to you here, and it's very clear to me that you guys know how to shoot a rocket. You can put it where you want it with precision. You can put it in a one-inch square. You know how to get that engine to run. That sucker will run and never does it. We've never had one yet to choke down like my car. I mean, it just boogies on. And I said, I've listened to that, and you guys are good. What it looks to me like is that you're spending your time trying to keep from killing each other while you're building that rocket. And he looked at me, and he said, that's exactly right. That is exactly what we find. Then he started telling me about the inner workings of just about any organization. Communication's a big problem. You know, good unity and good cooperation, big problem. Who gets credit, big problem. And so he's telling me all of that. And I said, well, the reason I say a tradition, what they're about is how to get people to work together in unity. That's what it's about. And so we just talked for a few minutes about that, and it was almost like Bill calling on Dr. Bob. Rocket scientist looked at me. He said, you know, I'm going to go home and take a good hard look at that. And we exchanged email addresses. I haven't heard from him yet. He may be sitting on Pluto or somewhere. But I haven't heard from him yet. But it's exactly right. You know, because the fundamental problems in most institutions are not complex stuff. It's about how to get people to work together, how to get a team to work, you know, so you can get something done. And so that, to me, is what tradition's about. And I'll be interested. It doesn't matter to me. I mean, whether he uses it or not, that's his problem. But boy, did I ever find this useful in organizations I managed. And so I use them in every aspect of my life. My family knows more about AA traditions than most members because we use them. We use them in our lives. We've used them in there. And I mean, we don't have a bunch of AA robots in our house. We've got just functioning human beings. But it's one where stress will come. Any family's going to have stress from time to time. And so I want to just sort of take off on these things with that perspective of I may expand it to organization, but I'll predominantly want to talk about just from a personal level. You know, what does this mean to me as an individual and to the folks with whom I'm closely associated? And so when you look at them, anybody got a big, that's a terrible question to ask an AB. Anybody got a big book? That's can I borrow it?
Yes, sir.
I'll pay you back. I swear I will.
Yes.
Checks in the mail. I just want to find tradition because I can't recite stuff. I do. And if you don't know them, I'm getting by with it. But I'm usually lying if I start quoting something. I just want to find that so I can give you the real version of it. And I'm going to do the short form rather than the long one. Except for one. And when we get to the third tradition, I'm going to do the long one in that one. But I also got my glasses in my room. I think I can make it with these lasers thing. Hey, Howard. Howard.
Thank you.
Bless your heart. I appreciate the thought. Oh, my kind of book. It's my kind of book. The first one is that our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends on AA unity. Let me reword that a little bit. My recovery comes first. And you can go to the bank on that. You know, I love you guys. I've been here with you, and I love you. I haven't heard an ugly word since, well, wait a minute, back, I said too much. It's been a real good weekend. Hadn't been a single fight, not a one, a good bunch. And I love you. But I got limits on that. Yeah, I had an old buddy that used to, he's dead now, but he used to do a fair amount of talking around the program. He did a wonderful job, really wonderful job. And he used to say, and I know it was a rhetorical statement, but he used to say to a group, like as if, I'm not going to say it, but he would say to a group, if one of us has to drink again, you, the group, or me, he would say, I hope it's me instead of you. Now, that's sweet, isn't it? That is sweet. That's dumb. That is flat dumb what that is. You won't hear me saying that. Now, none of us have to drink again. I hope to God none of us do. But if we do, you bet I want to be the last dude standing. Yes, and that's exactly the way I look at it. So my welfare comes first. But my recovery depends on unity. You know, I said with a good bit of feeling yesterday that I am a member of the primary purpose group of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm a member. I don't just visit there or drop in or go for fellowship. I belong to that group, rain or shine. Now, that's the one place in this world where if a problem happens, it's my problem. Nobody needs to ask me to respond to it. It's mine. Because I'm going to take care of that group. My welfare depends on the unity of that group. And so I'm going to contribute everything I need to do. I'll tell you two other examples. I like to spend a little bit of time on the first because first tradition is just like the first step. It's the launching pad for everything else. And this one little business thing. I was managing an organization, a statewide organization, and I was going to a facility just to visit. And I went in, and you know how folks will do that work for you. I went in, and they were waiting, and they'd already sort of figured out what they wanted to do to test the old man. So I go in, and the director says, here's the situation that we've got, a pretty tough situation. And he described the situation. It was a little tough. It was a human interaction. Somebody was going to win, somebody's going to lose. And he said, we were just wondering what you would do. Well, he didn't, now you had to listen to the question. He didn't say, what do you think I ought to do? He wasn't wanting that. Now, what he wanted to know is what I would do. He wanted to just sort of verify the legitimacy of his decision. And I said, well, let me think about that just a couple minutes. And I thought a couple minutes. And what I thought about was first tradition. Because that's exactly what it was. Now, I could have spent a half a day reading the personnel manual, law books, and into a whole bunch of stuff and interviewing and all this stuff. But it's a simple deal. It was a simple deal. What's in the best interest of that organization? on that decision. And when I look at that, it becomes a real easy thing. So I told him what I would do, and he smiled, and that's the end of it. I never have asked him what he did, because he didn't ask for that. Yeah, I trust him. He's a good manager, and I trust him to do the job. But it's simple. You know, when you cut down to what you're really talking about is how an organization works, you know, and what's in the interest of the welfare. My family, for example, I said I use it in family, and I do. Give you just one example of many. One example of how I use it in family. And believe me, we've used most of them in our family. We did for a while. Am I okay with this where I am? Okay. We did for a long time what a lot of families do. We would celebrate Christmas by having a spending orgy. And so what we'd do would be to buy a bunch of junk. Well, what junk? It was expensive stuff. But we treated it like junk. You know, our kids had toys that they threw away just because they died of old age and the box never been opened. You know, that kind of stuff. You know, I got ties that I wouldn't wear to a dog fight. I've had them 25 years, but they're nice, expensive ties. I may see somebody needs one someday. But I'm not going to wear those suckers. And so we were in this deal, and I just hated that. I mean, my God, I just despise Christmas coming because we go through that silly thing. Well, I thought I was the minority in that position. So I told the gang, I said, well, only four of us there, your wife and son and daughter. So we got the four of us together one day, and I said, let's talk about something. And they said, what? So I told them, ran it down. I was absolutely amazed to learn that out of four people in my family, four people hated it. I thought my wife was the cheerleader. I thought she was leading the charge. She hated it worse than anybody else. But we're doing it just because we're caught up in this obligation. And so we said, shoot, that's stupid. So we put a limit of $50 on any gift. That's the most we're going to spend. And we decided instead to find a family that would have no family unless somebody provided for them. And for the last several years, that's what we do. Yeah, we don't even know them, you know, but we know folks that know people in that boat, and so we'll find a family. And they don't know who it is, but a bunch of people show up unloading stuff. We've never been turned down, I'll tell you that. And last year, I am dumb as a post sometimes. We were thinking about it, and there was a Mexican fellow there, delightful man. Delightful man. He's in AA, has been for a good while. Nice man. And he got his green card screwed up. And you know, there's a lot of heat going on with that. This guy served in the United States Army, has eight kids, and no job. And so I'm hunting around for a family, and my son said, how about Miguel? I said, well, I was going to say that. I hadn't given it a thought. You're a dummy. I got eight kids is a natural. But see what I'm talking about? You know, the welfare of the family. You know, of thinking of something other than obligatory responsibilities that we've got and do something that really makes us love each other. You know, and so that's just one example, you know, of ways where traditions can come through without a whole bunch of histrionics and carrying on. Just getting to a point of what is in the interest of our common welfare. And man, we have great Christmases. We really have great. Old Miguel did too last time. His daughter called me and she said, I haven't met you, but you let your family know that if you guys hadn't done that, we wouldn't have had a Christmas at our place. That's good stuff. That is good stuff. And so anyway, just a little product. The second one for our group purpose. There's but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. I'm the oldest and the biggest in my family, but I don't boss that family. Yeah, we're four grown people now. And so we don't boss each other around. You know, we treat each other as responsible adults. And so the spirit of that you know, so that, you know, I'm not the guy that has to bail out every crisis and all that kind of stuff. We're in something as a family. We're in it together. And that there is no leader. God's the leader at our house. That's it. You know. And let me bring it into A just a little bit too directly into A. But that's an important principle from the personal standpoint. That a couple of things in there are kind of important words to me. For our group purpose, what is our group purpose? It's well stated in the fifth tradition. Each group has but one primary purpose. One, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Now that means every time we meet, whether it's on McKenzie River, or downtown Portland, or at the International in Toronto, in Brussels, Belgium, it doesn't matter. Wherever we meet, however many of us there are, the only reason we meet is to better carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Sometimes we'll lose it in the clamor and confusion, but that's why we meet. And so for each gathering, our group purpose is to carry that out. And in doing that, there's only one authority. Now the way I like to look at it, this means for our group purpose, that's carrying the message to the alcoholic. And for the purpose of this tradition at a personal level, you know, I'm free to carry the message however I see fit. I've got to do what I honestly believe is the right way to do it. And I'm free to do that. And so is every other member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and especially my home group, that we're all free to carry that message, because all of us have different ways. Every one of us in this room are totally different in terms of how we approach them. So we don't want to get into, you know, I mentioned one of the earlier sessions about we're trying to gear ourselves up to do 12-step work. And I'm a little skeptical because I'm not sure that's something you can conceptually put in place. We're trying, but we'll see. But each one of us as an individual and as a group, has to find our own way through our individual conscience, group conscience, to carry out that purpose. Group conscience, just my own bias on this thing, I think is probably the most trivialized thing in Alcoholics Anonymous. We use that to cover everything from business meetings to car washers. It's amazing how far we'll stretch that to cover everything we do. And to me, a group conscience has a much more serious intent. It's a place where we prayerfully consider an issue, a concern, a decision that may impact on our primary purpose. And so it deserves weighty concern. An example on that with the thing we're doing at our group, I was talking to somebody here earlier about it. It's been wrong for a long time, but it didn't seem too wrong till gasoline prices went way up in the air. And when we invite speakers, we plan our programs a quarter ahead, so we invite speakers pretty well ahead. And we're looking for the quality of speakers who've got a message is what we're looking for. And so we'll have people come in, who may drive your 150, 200 miles round trip to come in and carry the message. And I tell you one thing brought it home to me one night. I went up to a neighboring state. The guy just called me, asked me to come up, that they were going to have a covered dish and they were celebrating his anniversary. And I said, yeah, okay. Went up there. Long trip. And normally I don't pay that much attention to it, but for some reason it just caught my eye because gas prices were going up. The gasoline alone to make that trip was $80-something for me to make that trip. And I thought about, you know, we at that meeting and we all had a good time. I put in $80 and everybody else put in a buck or two. There's something wrong with that. A little something wrong with that. You know, that is way short of self-support, eh? And so I got to think about that. And I just brought it up to our group a while back. We're doing a group conscience on it right now, which means we're not going to make a snap decision. But we will make one by the end of, we probably won't complete it till November. We're going to sync it with the area and make sure we're together on what we do. And anyway, we're just going to time it that way. And in the meantime, we're prayerfully considering. I was really proud of my home group because part of what gave us pause was that if we start reimbursing speakers, and we have one every week, and if we start reimbursing speakers, it will have significant impact on our contributions to all of our service entities. Our group, and yours may be the same way, our group once a quarter goes broke by design. We take care of our basic expenses, and then everything that's left down to a prudent reserve is donated indiscriminately. We have four places we send it. We send it intergroup, district, area, and the general service office. And that's routine. You don't have to plan to do it. We just do it automatically. Well, I was really pleased when there was hesitancy about doing this because folks could recognize that's going to run into some money. And the real concern was that it would cause us to have to reduce the contributions to other people, other entities. That's a good, honest concern. That's a good issue for a group conscious to deal with. And I'm not 100% sure where we'll go with it. I have a hunch that we're gonna come out doing this, what I'm believing. But I feel good about our group having those kind of priorities. I just sort of casually mentioned, I'm going to mention it a little louder, that, the world has changed a good bit in the last 73 years. We're putting a buck in the plate 73 years ago, still doing it now. Come on, that's not real world stuff, is it? So I'm just going to let the news out. Our group may not know that this has changed a little bit. We may want to put $2 in there. Yeah, never know. At least we can drop a hint anyway. So anyway, that's very, very significant. That stuff we were talking about yesterday on the group conscience and how important that is in generating the ideas and the things that we need to communicate in the fellowship. That's where it comes from. Out of a group conscience where stuff will surface. One last thing on that. Leaders, but trusted servant. Leader's not a dirty word in AA. Sometimes we'll avoid it. But that's not a dirty word. That is a very vital word. And there is a huge, huge need for leadership. And that doesn't mean bosses. It just means people that are willing to step forward and pick up some responsibility and carry it out. That's all it means. And I mentioned my own definition of a leader, anybody over 5 years. That's just mine. But it's pretty generous kind of a door for that. I will tell you just one story about what you get into with this kind of thing. Well, I think y'all might have gathered. I didn't tell the story, but y'all might have gathered. I started AA in a correctional institution and was introduced in an excellent group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I was released and came home, I had a contact set up with a guy that became my sponsor, and then another man that was agreed to meet me the day I got on the ground in my town. And the fellow that met me that day when I got off the bus, I called a guy. He was an old guy. He's a plumber by trade, but he's just a fine old gentleman and nice guy. So he drove me to meetings, and then for a long time I couldn't drive anything. I didn't have anything to drive, but I couldn't if I did. And so we got a routine going that every I'd call him every week. I never did just say, well, just why don't we just make this permanent and you just pick me up every Tuesday night? I didn't want to do that. Well, he's given a gift and I didn't want to take that for granted. I wanted him to hear me say, can I get a ride? See, it got so when I would call, he'd answer the phone, county poorhouse. Well, I mean, I told you he's a plumber, so it obviously was not a poorhouse. Plumbers are rich as a bull. So he would, but it's just fun, eh? Great guy. We hit it off strong. Well, the little old ragtag group that they were trying to have was nothing. I mean, it was nothing. He was the only member. They had one good member and he moved, not because I came, but the timing was excruciatingly plain. He left town when I came in. No, he was my second sponsor. And the old man is all that was left. And a few rotating members that would come in once in a while. Well, went to work in there. And it's not too hard to get a group going. We got something going there. And it's funny about this whole business about the rotating leadership and how important that is. this fella had been the treasurer of that group for 7 years. The group had existed 7 years. He'd been the treasurer for 7 years. Well, if people hold a job too long, they own it, you know. And for long, you get real possessive about stuff. And that happened to old man. And, well, we started getting moving and the group started growing. And we started running into a little bit of problems that sometimes, you know, if somebody bring in some cookies or something and they want to get reimbursed, Mr. Mack's what we called him, said, well, Mr. Mack, the cookies were $2. And he would say, my, those cookies are sure expensive. Yeah. Well, I was giving them away. But people are sensitive, you know. And they'd get their feelings hurt because they thought he was challenging their reimbursement. And so it got to be a real rippling kind of a thing. And I'd been there about 3 or 4 months, and we were getting the elements of a group. And so one night we had an election. Now, you've seen the AA elections. A lot of times, boy, I'm telling you, it's not even, well, it's just ridiculous. I mean, you open the nominate somebody, close it quick before they can back out. You know, that's the election. And but this was a little different. We had we were going to put in a full slate of officers. And chairman was a no-brainer. Man, that was easy. And secretary, nothing to it. GSR, piece of cake. We got to treasurer. And I'll tell you, now that old man and I had formed a great relationship. He loved me dearly, and I know that. And I loved him. It was like more like father-son than anything else. And so when the nomination came up for treasurer, I was wanting anybody in that group other than me to make the nomination because I knew it would hurt more coming from me than it would anybody else. Well, that was the quietest AA meeting place I have ever seen. Man, you could hear an eye blink. And I tell you, it was stony quiet. And I'm sitting there. Well, sometimes you find out what you're made out of. You either mean it or you don't. You're either going to stand on principles or you're not. And sometimes you just have to move beyond personality. And I love that old man. And I knew if we elected a new treasurer, it was going to hurt him bad. But we got a group to think about. We got tradition one, a common welfare to look after. This guy's been 7 years, Jeff. So I stuck up my hand, made a nomination, hardest nomination ever made in my life. And the election was done. And I'd like to tell you, the old man was resilient and he snapped back. He didn't. He really never got over it. He stayed sober. But it took the life out of him. You know, it just took the life out. And his identity was gone. You know, his real connection was gone. And tough decision. But sometimes, if you're going to try to operate by principles, you have to take a lonely stand. Because somebody got to take a stand, you know, or else it doesn't matter. You know, it doesn't matter. And it was tough duty. But I left that town 2 years later, and we had 60 members in that group. And it wasn't all because of him. You know, naturally, he was just one fella that was just sort of standing there. But it was just, you know, the group had to grow. And so, anyway, sometimes it's tough duty. And these things, they'll guide you where to go, but they don't necessarily make it any easier. The third one is about membership. I'll read the long one on that one because the short one, this doesn't say much. The only requirement of membership. Key word, membership. I believe I heard somebody else say that here this weekend. Membership is a key word. You know, anybody can attend an AA meeting, but attending and being a member are two different things. You know, first probably year or so that I was in AA, I was not a member. I didn't really believe I was an alcoholic. You know, and so it couldn't be a member if I don't even believe I've got the disease we're treating. And so I didn't have membership until I got to the point where I genuinely accepted the fact that I'm an alcoholic. No doubt about it. That's when I had membership. So that's why membership's a key word even in the short term form. And then the fourth in the big book printing here, long form is a little bit more definitive. It says, our membership ought to include all who suffer from alcoholism. Hence, we may refuse none who wish to recover. Nor ought AA membership ever depend upon money or conformity. Any two or three alcoholics gathered together for sobriety may call themselves an AA group, provided that as a group they have no other affiliation. We went over it just a little bit in an earlier session. But that's a hugely important tradition. You know, I know very few places that I've been in the last 20 years that before we even get out of the airport parking lot, the issue of singleness of purpose comes up. I mean, almost always. And we don't even get to pay the toll, and it's already on the floor. Because it's a big matter of concern. It's one of the other things that became rampant, just like a lot of us did when treatment broke the floodgates, and we started getting people. Well, I won't go back to all of that, but just reflect on one thing. I was talking about 12-step work and then the loyalty that's generated in that. Well, when you start having people that are referred into Alcoholics Anonymous by non-members, you're not going to have a heck of a lot of thought about who you're referring. And so a lot of times people don't really make referrals to AA. They dump folks in AA is about what happened. And so that's where a lot of that sort of wholesale kind of growth of people who really didn't see themselves as just alcoholic. And so you started getting a lot of the double entendres, like, you know, alcoholic addict and that on and on. And so it a big problem to deal with. And so there are literally places in this country that have given up any pretense of singleness of purpose. I mean, make no pretense about it. They've totally just said whatever. Well, you know, every one of us has got to find our own place on that. Every one of us. And I'll tell you what it comes down to for me. I'll give you an example. I sponsor a group in a prison. And I was over there one night a while back. And it needed to elect a chairman. It went through the procedure. It was very well done. And then they opened the nominations, and somebody nominated a guy named Mike. Well, Mike was not an alcoholic. I knew him. He was the chairman of the Narcotics Anonymous group. And he was visiting the group. But Mike was a nice guy. And because they nominated him, he was just sitting there, and he was going to do it. Well, the group started to vote. Now, I'm an outside sponsor of that group. I'm not a visitor. I'm the outside sponsor. So when they started to vote, I said, whoa, hold on. Now, I hated to do it because I don't like to deal with that kind of stuff publicly. It's always embarrassing. But I'm not going to stand there and watch a service position go down the tube. I'm not going to do that. And so I said, Mike can't serve. He's not a member. And AA meetings are conducted, or AA meetings are conducted by AA members. And Mike is nodding because he understood. And I felt bad about it. I apologized to him after the meeting, and he fully understood. You know, he was okay. But I hated to do it that way. And so we went ahead and finished the election. At the end of the meeting, the chairman said, Tom, a lot of us in here are pretty confused about this whole business, like what you were saying with Mike. That it was singleness of purpose. And you know how in promises it says we will intuitively know how to handle situations that used to baffle us? That's true. You're going, I'm no rocket science. I couldn't even talk to the man that flew that rocket. That I'm no rocket science. But when that guy said, would you explain more, I didn't have time to research anything and make something up. I just had to resort to the truth. And so I intuitively responded. And what I said to him, I had never said before. A lot of times since, but never before. And it's just an intuitive response. I said, do you remember when Bill Wilson met Bob Smith in Akron, Ohio? And the guys had read the history and they'd heard the history. And everybody said, yeah, we do. And I said, do you remember when they got through with the meeting what Bob, the physician, said to Bill, the stockbroker? The physician said, finally, somebody understands. Now, I believe, I don't know what you believe, but it's important, I think, that you believe, that you have a belief. Because this is a big, big problem in Alcoholics Anonymous to deal with. And I said, what happened the day that Bob said that to Bill? The basic tenet of Alcoholics Anonymous was formed. Our whole program is predicated on the belief that when one alcoholic talks to another one sincerely about what life is like, that it has an ability to generate understanding like nothing this world has ever seen. That's the basic tenet of AA. And I said to the guys, and I'd say it to you, that that's either true or it's false. If it's true, then I think every one of us who call ourselves recovered alcoholics have an absolute responsibility to assure that the next person who walks through our door gets what we advertise. If we say this is Alcoholics Anonymous, that's what it needs to be. If we say that you could come in here and you will be at home and you'll be with people who understand your problem, that's what we need to deliver. And so I think it's a hugely important thing. And I don't know what it'll take to deal with it, but it's in our laps is where it is. And I think every one of us, my imagination, flight of fantasy, I wish we could just have a worldwide group conscience on this. And let every single one of us, because I think ultimately that's what we have to do. None of us can just stand like we're spectators, because we're either part of it. We're part of the solution or part of the problem, one or the other. And so I think it is it's obviously a very important issue. And there are ways to deal with it. Let me go just a little bit further on that. That there are very reasonable ways to deal with this. Now, I'm just telling you Tom I stuff. You've got your own belief system. You've got your own idea. Let me tell you mine. I believe that Alcoholics Anonymous is the last stop on the bus line. I believe that. And I believe that anybody who comes to our door looking for help needs to receive, at a minimum, a warm welcome. A warm welcome. It is the last stop on the bus line. And I don't want some doorkeeper saying, out of here, you know, at a minimum. My belief is that they ought to have a warm welcome. And if they happen to be clearly in the wrong place, loving guidance to find the right place. We make it our business in my group to have numbers for people in Narcotics Anonymous, CA, SA, whatever. We got every A in the book covered. And we want that. We want to be able to provide that. And so that's the general spirit. The worst possible way to deal with this problem is publicly. I've seen it happen. You may have too. Where somebody comes in and they got off the bus at the wrong stop. And somebody just rudely says, hey, you don't belong here. You know, you get to get out, go down the street or something. Yeah. That's no way to treat somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous, for God's sake. Yeah, we can do better than that. I'll give you just a couple of something to think about. Howard and Eddie and I, we were talking about it at dinner tonight. Not this particular issue, but the same kind of issue. A couple of things, how you deal with it. It can be the easiest thing in the world to deal with. Now, if you just try to do it at the personal level so that you're just confronting people and all this kind of stuff, that's hard work. And it just doesn't work well. And anytime you do it publicly, somebody's going to get embarrassed. Usually two somebodies. But you're going to get embarrassed. It's just not the way to do business. In the group that I was in before the one I'm in now, I was, one night a guy came to me and he said, Tom, we need to do a group inventory. Now that's an unusual request. And this guy just moved down from New York City, inner city guy, and I thought, this is really a weird request. And I said, why is that? He said, well, we got too many drug addicts in here. And I said, what are you talking about? And he said, well, you look around. Well, and I, honest to God, I get busy, and I just had not noticed. And so I said, let me take a look, see if I see the same thing. And what it was, like most of our wounds, is self-inflicted. Most of our wounds are not imposed. We earn them. And so I took a look at what it was. Somebody had a facility, and they were capturing young aliens. You know what I mean? I mean, just young, kind of crazy kids. And they were scooping them up and getting them in this place. And they were loading them on the van and sending them out to places that might offer help. So, and our place was one of the stops. Well, those kids didn't know if they were alcoholics, addicts, sheep, or goats. They had no clue. I mean, they were just wild kids like I was at that age. And so we took a look, and then we had a little huddle with the steering committee and said, what do we need to do? And we decided we needed to go see the director of that facility. And they asked me if I'd do that, and I said, sure will. And I went over, and a nice young lady, MSW, that was just as kind and cordial and cooperative as could possibly be. And so I explained to her what the problem was. She said, oh, I didn't know you had such things as close. Well, where would she learn it, for God's sakes? They don't teach that in social work programs, nor physicians or ministers or school teachers or anybody else that I know of. So if we want people to know it, they're going to have to learn it from us or just not know. And so she as soon as she understood, well, she said, we'll take care of that. And I knew better. Yeah, I've worked with young people enough to know that that is like herding cats. You know, we're going to have to do more of that. So we set up a newcomer meeting, just like we were talking about. And we made it an open meeting, deliberately. We made it meet at the same time as our regular meeting, deliberately. We didn't want it to be before or after. We wanted it to be instead of. And in, well, it's been 30 years counting that group and the one I'm in now, we have not had one single problem having to do with singleness of purpose. Because what we're doing is dealing with it structurally rather than just personal hand managing the deal. And it's so much better to have a system that's understood. And so we have, you know, when we were forming our group, I mentioned a little bit about that. We formed it, put all the service committees. One of them we put in was the newcomer group, and that guy came to me and said, no newcomers. And I told him to start a meeting, and the minute he started it, they opened that newcomer group, it was full. I mean, right off the bat. And it's been that way ever since. And so what it did was just absolutely provided a resource for people that have got folks trapped, don't know what they are, what to do with them. So it's that simple. It's a simple way to deal something without starting the Third World War or getting a whole bunch of mayhem, you know. And so it's a very simple kind of a thing to do. And very effective thing to do, too, by the way. And we can talk a bit about this later. I'm trying to save just a few minutes for questions anyway. That Chris said you can zip through those traditions in no time, then it will do the question thing. Right. Each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. I like to rephrase that. Each member should be autonomous, except in matters affecting other members or the group or AA as a whole. That means that I've got the freedom to handle myself like I want to here. If I want to come in here wearing a purple wig and a tail down to the floor, fine. You know, nobody's going to be raising a holy cane with me here. We're sort of having a relaxed weekend. But we are autonomous as members, provided we don't interfere with somebody else's freedom to be the same. Now, that's a responsibility. That's a responsibility. You know, I've got the right to conduct myself in a meeting as I will, but I don't have the right to offend you, a guest, or anybody else. Let me give you a real live example of that. Somebody reminded me of that. Anybody, somebody. It might have been Sharon. It reminded me. My wife and I went over to to Tennessee, just an adjoining state to us, to a little conference. And they had a guy speak in front Saturday night. I'd never seen him before or since. But somebody got him from somewhere. And the guy thought he was supposed to be a stand-up comic. And he wasn't funny. I mean, the boy, poor fellow, the best he had sucked. And I mean, they were nothing. And you know how it is when you're going down the tube. You start scrambling. You paddle faster, you know, trying to get out. Well, that's what he was doing. And as he proceeded to drown and paddle frantically, he got worse every step of the way. And he went past profane and the vulgar and X-rated. And I'm telling you, it was an absolute travesty. It was a travesty. And I was sitting, my wife and I, now I don't talk in front of my wife like that. And I sure don't appreciate some other clown doing it either. So I didn't like it. I didn't like it one bit. But I was mild compared to the couple sitting right in front of me. The woman who had invited the speakers. Yeah, kind of like these guys did here. It's a lonely spot when you invite us in. I said, God, I hope he does okay. God, he'll run me out of Oregon. It's a lonely place. Well, this gal that had invited the speakers right in front of me, and she was just squirming. Yeah. And I said, boy, she's not happy. And the guy beside her, I was absolutely fascinated with him. You know how people do when they get mad? I mean, he just got red. He looked like a thermometer, literally. His neck got red. His ears were glowing. And I said, that boy really is not happy. And so when the fellow, he didn't quit. He just gave up. Thank God. Yeah, we gave him a standing ovation for quitting. And well, bad. But after the meeting, I went over to the gal that was the speaker chair, and I said, looked like you had a rough night. And she said, you just don't know. And I said, well, it really looked like your friend sitting with you especially had a bad night. And she said, Tom, you will never know how humiliated I was. I've never been more embarrassed in my life. That was her minister at his first meeting. And I will absolutely guarantee you it was his last meeting. That boy wouldn't come back to AA if it was the last place on earth that had water. What a disservice, eh? You know, one person's going to get a little flip and casual and a little overdue this freedom to be myself. And forget the responsibility that goes with standing up and publicly declaring yourself an AA member. I think there's a big responsibility that goes with that. That if I'm going to stand up and let people see me as an AA member, my golly, I want to make it look like a good place to be. That this is not some haven for a bunch of hoodlums. This is a bunch of folks who are trying to get well from a desperate condition. And the very least I can do is to uphold a standard of decency when I'm doing that. And I tell you the other thing. I said my last three 12-step calls came from ministers. I guarantee you none came from that guy. He would refer somebody to hell before he'd refer them to AA. So just a simple-sounding thing like that, eh? Just a simple-sounding thing. And so with freedom comes responsibility. And I'm free. But I'm not free to destroy the vessel that I'm sailing in. And it's a responsibility to go with that autonomy. And you know, I mean, I guarantee you I've got as rough a history as anybody in here. But you can hurry up and believe it is history. I didn't drag it in here with me. I left that out there. I've got a new life here. And I believe we open the meeting with a prayer and we usually close it with prayer. And I'm not going to fill the inner space with a bunch of stuff that sounds street corner. I'm just not going to do that. And so I think it is a heavy responsibility that goes with it. The fifth is what we talk about. Each group has but one primary purpose: to carry his message to the alcoholic still suffers. And you know, as a member, now I do a lot of stuff, and you do too. But I've got one primary purpose. You know, when you get down to what is it that's really important to me to contribute,
It's really that. You know, it's like it says in the book that our dark history can become our greatest asset for dealing with others. And so, you know, that history is a valuable thing. It gives me a real purpose. That I could say it real quick like this. I had a lady that I worked with that gave me one of those little signs you stick on the wall, you know, that, you know, how to live life in three easy lessons or something, you know, just stuff. She gave me one, and it really caught my attention. It said, I think this is right, it's close anyway, life breaks us all sometimes. And boy, we know that, don't we? Life breaks us all sometimes. But we often grow back strongest at the place we were broken. How true. How true. That my greatest asset is my history of where I was broken, where I found God, where I was healed, and where I found a way to be of useful service and useful purpose in life. That's the greatest story I'll ever have. Greatest purpose. And so that's primary. You know, I'll do that over everything. And my God, you know, when you've got, you're sensitized to that thing, what an enormous opportunity to be able to share that story with tons and tons of people. You know, I'll tell you one little story. It doesn't exactly have to do this, but it comes close. There's a, you know, I'm sort of tuned in to you know, picking up on people. I try to be conscious of the folk around me and folks that have needs and stuff like that. And I want to be responsive to that. I don't want to just walk by and ignore people that are having a hard time. And I was on a plane one time, and we were landing, and I was watching the fella at the seat next to me. And he was, now you talk about white knuckling. This boy was white knuckling. And he was gripping at those chair arms. And I thought, yeah, geez, I ought not to embarrass this guy by telling him I'm noticing that. But I thought, I think I will. So I just went ahead and I said, rough, ain't it? I didn't say any more. I didn't need to say any more. He just absolutely came unglued. He said, man, you will never know how rough it is. He said, every time we take off or land, I am scared to death. Now, I don't know what I'm going to do. I sell for a living. I travel the entire United States. I have to fly. And I don't know what I'm going to do. Now, I believe, Kent knows, I believe that a little bit of lying is okay if it's for a spiritual purpose. Yeah, and so, I mean, I didn't tell a big one, but he told me that, and I said, you know, I had that problem. I didn't tell him it was one time for 10 seconds that I had a little panicky feeling. That's all. But it was true, you know, close. And he said, my God, what'd you do? And I said, well, I belong to a program. And we have a little prayer that I use in a lot of circumstances. I've used it in this circumstance, and I have. And he said, what is it? So I recited the Serenity Prayer to him. He said, wait a minute. He got out his pad. You know, every salesman got a pad ready to write. And he said, say that again. You know, so he started writing it down. You know. And so, you see, you know, the primary purpose will come out. It doesn't matter whether it's to a salesman or a taxi driver or somebody hitchhiking. It doesn't matter. You know, it's that story of broken and healing that's got so much to do with this whole business of contributing something to life instead of draining everything I see. And so that very much is staying with me. I'll tell you just one other thing about that. I'm a Methodist. Not too many people at the Methodist Church know it, but I am. And and we change ministers a lot. It's like, hey, they rotate ministers, you know, just like we do the service people. Well, we send a little something to the church, you know, and you know, just sort of whatever you do, just give them some money. And normally when they change ministers, they'll see this coming in from some unknown person. And so they'll typically drop by the house to see who's sending that. And they'll come in and we'll go through this awkward conversation, you know, how do you do and wanted to meet you and all this stuff. And they'll normally say something like, we don't ever see you at church. I said, that's right, I'm not there. And he said, and I told him, I said, well, I'm kind of what they call a buzzard member. Yeah, I come every time there's something to eat or somebody dies, you know. So I'm not a regular guy at the church. And he said, he asked me why not. And I told him what I've told everyone I've ever told. I told him exactly what I do. Because about every Sunday of my life, I'm doing what you're doing. You just got a different venue. And so I told him what I do. You know, and normally most every weekend I'm tied up somewhere. And I've never had a single one to say anything different. They'll say, that's great. That's great. You keep on getting it. I said, I will, you too. Well, we work in vineyards, just different ones, you know. And so, never had anybody. But wouldn't I look, Noel, you wouldn't know this, how silly I'd look if I was down there trying to participate in the choir. Man, you talk about a member getting defrocked. I guarantee you they'd defrock me. Yeah, but it's just what that is. It lines up, you know, what is it that I've got to offer that's really something of value to me? Six is AA group ought never endorse finance or lend AA name to any related facility or outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from our primary purpose. You know, it's really talking about how property can pull up, money, property, prestige can pull us away from our purpose. And my God, is that easy to do, eh? Yeah, there's I won't mention names or places, but there are a lot of places in this country and, some more than others, where about every group feels like they've got to have a building of their own or rented space. There's a lot of these kind of meetings I was talking about earlier, you know, where people just kind of gather. And, you know, you'll get a building and have 35 meetings a week, you know. What do you suppose their primary purpose is? You better believe it, to pay that rent. And so money, you know, property can pull you away, you know, from that deal. I've got some folks asked me to come down to a neighboring town a while back, and I heard they had a new clubhouse that they built down there, and I knew that they couldn't afford a new clubhouse. So I said, okay, fine. They said, we want to show you the club. I said, okay, I'll take a look. And so got down there. They had built a club on the 13th hole of the golf course at the local country club. Now, I guarantee you, they don't give that dirt away. You're talking big green. And so I smelled a rat. Well, it didn't take too long to smell that rat. And so I went in, and the guy said, we want to show you the club. I said, now look, don't tell me too much about it because I don't want to know. He said, why not? I said, I have a hunch if I listen to how you guys bought this, I'll be an accessory after the fact of a crime, and I don't want to be in on it. Yeah. So I don't know where they got the money. But I guarantee you it didn't come out of collection plate. I guarantee you that. It came out of quibbling on traditions and sneaking one under, you know, and something like that. All it is just selling your soul for a few bucks is what it is. So this whole business about money, property, and prestige is an extremely important thing. I'll tell you a couple other things that I think illustrate to you. You know, what it can do, it's one thing to think of it corporately, like a building or stuff like that. But what does it do to me as an individual? I'll tell you a story. A 12-step call I had a while back, not one of these last three from the minister. But I had a 12-step call, and I knew when it came in, I knew the area, and it was a real high-rent district. I mean, a major league high-rent district. And I knew the area, didn't know the house, but I knew the area, and went over. And I got a guy that I was sponsoring who was brand new in the program, so I took him with me. So we go over to this stately mansion there, really. And went to the door and knocked, and the guy came to the door wearing a smoking jacket. I'd never seen one with a person in it. I mean, I'd seen them hanging around. I never seen one with a person. Here's this weaselly old drunk sitting in that smoking jacket looking grand, you know. And it had Sinatra playing in the background. So I sat down and listened to a little of that. And he finally... He said he wasn't too bad. I mean, he was bad enough, but he wasn't real bad. You know, he was just in the zone. And he said, would you like me to tell you about myself? And I said, why don't you do that? That'd be interesting. And he said, what we're doing here today is not new to me. He said, I've been treated almost everywhere in the United States. I just got out of a treatment center somewhere out west. I believe it might have been your state. that ripped me off for $30,000. He said, I've talked to every expert that I have ever heard of in the United States. The last guy that did with me what you're doing with me tonight ripped me off for $300,000. He said, what do you suppose you could tell me that I haven't already heard? Well, again, intuitively, know how to handle the situation. I said, probably nothing. But I said, let me tell you this that I want you to know. I wouldn't sell you 30 minutes of my time doing what we're doing for $300,000 or any price. This guy and I are here because we love you. We don't even know you, but we love you. You want to see a drunk get quiet. The fun and games were over, and that old boy settled right down. See, think about that. Yeah, if we'd have gone at him and tried to out-slick the slicksters, you know, tried to be a lot smarter than the other people or tell them I know a more reasonable treatment, sir, my God, we would have gotten nowhere. No, we had to get below all of that bluster, all of that stuff that he's hiding behind. And that money had been his biggest enemy to a solution. And when he found out that AA is not something you can buy at any price or sell at any price, you know, this is a spiritual gift. It has to be that. Now, that old boy was very quiet, and he died sober about 11 years later. Yeah. You know, last time I saw him, I was in the airport at Dallas at DFW. I was walking down the concourse heading to Cucumber, Georgia, or somewhere. I don't know where. I was going somewhere. And here I saw him and his wife, and we greeted each other, and I said, where are you off to? And he said, well, we're just going to run down to Acapulco for a couple of weeks and hang out. And I said, well, that's nice. He said, where are you going? And I told him Cucumber, Georgia, or somewhere. He didn't look thrilled at all. No interest in going with me. But anyway, it's what happens, eh? That when you get that property and prestige and money becomes your God, man, it also becomes your owner. Can become your owner. And this fella had just about drunk himself into the grave using that stuff as the barrier against the solution. And so, tremendously important about that. I don't get too carried away with his money, property, and prestige. Seven is about self-support. About self-support. And it's kind of an important thing for us that each group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. We probably tap dance around this tradition as much as any I know. And we really do get cute with it sometimes. That, far as I can tell, I wasn't there for the whole time, but far as I can tell, we have never been self-supporting one day since Alcoholics Anonymous has been in being. Never been self-supporting one day. And it doesn't mean we're stealing money or anything like this. I don't think we are. But if it wasn't for literature sales, we would have been bankrupt long ago. Long ago. That, you know, we talk about representation in the triangle. Representation in the pot. And last time I looked at the numbers, about 43% of registered groups contribute at all. 43%. When I came in AA, one of the things you heard often, a penny a day for your sobriety. That was the slogan the day I came in. And you literally, we could have handled our entire budget back then for a penny a day per member. Now it would cost us about little over $9 per member per year. Not month, year. And we could be fully self-supporting. We can't do that. You know, the price of a bottle of whiskey. And we can't do it. And so this whole business of self-support is a real strain for us, eh? You know, the way I look at it, I want to be self-supporting. I want to be fully self-supporting. And when I go to a group, I don't care whose it is, I want to do my best to contribute at least as much as I consume. at a minimum. Now, if I don't have any money, nobody's going to have any hard feelings. There are always other ways to make up. But I want to contribute as much as I can. I want to sort of factor what it costs to run this place and all that and put in accordingly. And then if I want to help somebody with my contribution, I want to put in a little more so that we can indeed reach out and not just take care of subsistence, but can actually help to carry this message. You know, a lot of time we try to do it in our group when we announce collections. Typically, you'll hear in a group, pretty typically, we have no dues or fees, but we have expenses. Well, what does that mean? You know, if you're sitting there and don't know anything about group, what does that mean? Nothing, really. But as a rule, when you make a pitch for that and say, here's what we do with it. You know, we take care of our local stuff. We take care of our intergroup, our district functions, our state functions. And in fact, we take care of functions all around the world. And we'll give examples of somebody receiving literature in a foreign country. And you know, when you feel that sense of purpose in that, AA members are the most generous folk I have ever seen for a specific purpose. If you just say to us, we need more money to support the fellowship, nothing will happen. But I guarantee you in this room tonight, if we said, there's a broken down facility down here where guys have got no big books, before we left this room tonight, I'll guarantee you we could provide as many big books as we needed. We just that way. We respond to specific needs. I just want to tell you one more story about that self-support. I do a lot of prison work. And I think it's critically important if you want folk in a prison or any place else, a treatment facility or whatever, it's very important to give them exposure to what AA is about, to what it is, and not get some sort of a different kind of concept to deal with those folk, and including self-support. When we started the group that I sponsor now, we were meeting with the warden and the management folk there, just sort of going over some ground stuff. And I mentioned that we wanted to get to a point that we could be self-supporting. And the warden was a nice fellow. He said, oh, come on. He knew me. He said, Tom, you know better than that, man. These guys don't have any money. I said, don't you kid yourself. Some of them got more money than me and you put together. But a lot of them are broke. I said, can you imagine how much dignity you can buy for 50 cents if that's about all you got? He said, well, we can probably do that. And so we do. And our group's self-supporting. And they are proud of that. God knows they'll tell anybody. I mean, they'll tell anybody that we are self-supporting. We drink up a lot of stuff after the meeting and we buy every bit of it. Yeah, it's a good thing. You can't help people understand AA principles by demonstrating what they're not. And I came out to California a while back. Guy called me and I didn't know him, but He told me what the deal was. He said, we want to see if we get you to come out here and speak to, we gather up AA members there. And, go to the federal penitentiary. And I said, sure, I'll be glad to do that if it fits in the schedule. And I said, I'd hate to tell you, but it'll be my main event. And he said, a few weeks later, I got a voucher or something, I think, from the federal penitentiary at that location. That's it right there. It's a voucher. Got that in the mail, and it's from the United States Penitentiary, and it's expenses for AA speaker. Well, now come on. You don't have to be a genius on tradition to smell that rat. And so I called a guy up and I said, I hate to tell you, buddy, but there's been a little mistake. And he said, what? And I said, told him what I had. I said, got a voucher from the federal prison. He said, no, that's not a mistake. That's the way we do it. And I said, well, that's not the way we do it. That may be the way you used to do it, but that's not the way we do it. And so we had a little conversation about seventh tradition, and he swore that he just didn't understand the tradition. I'm going to take him at his word. And I said, well, I'm sorry, I just can't do that. I could, but I'm not. I just will. I'm not working for the federal penitentiary. And I'm not letting the federal penitentiary.